Welcome back to the Roundtable. Elaine Weiss's new book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, rediscovers the story of American women rising up to claim their rights as their long fight for the vote reaches its climax in 1920. The story resonates today as a surge of women's political activism reshapes the national conversation, sweeping a record number of women into city halls, state legislatures, the halls of Congress, and the 2020 contest for the White House. The electoral pink wave of 2018 would not have been possible if not for the white and yellow wave of suffrage activists taking to the streets more than a century ago. In recent op-eds for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time, Daily Beast, Elaine Weiss has written compelling commentaries linking today's headlines to historical precedent drawn from her research. Again, the name of the new book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, and it's a pleasure to welcome Elaine Weiss to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you so much, Joe.
A great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for being with us. Give us a sense of why you think this putting this context out there is so important, so that so many of us understand the fight that brought us to the point where we are today.
Well, I think it's a story that's so important and so unknown. And I put myself in that category before I started research. It's the largest expansion of our democracy in our history. And it was a movement of grassroots activists, ordinary women who saw something very wrong in American society and said, we have to fix it. And so in many ways, it should give inspiration and hope to those who are working to improve our democracy today, and whether that's through changes in public policy or in voter rights or women's rights, they are all very important movements that begin with a recognition, a personal recognition that something is not right. So I want to tell this story because it is important. It is a great civil rights story and on its own. It also tells us a lot about our attitudes as a nation about democracy, which I think we need to reckon with again now, just as we did a century ago. And so I think when I see this wave of women being elected into office, that it was what the suffragists wanted. They thought that we would not have equality until women both help choose their lawmakers and help make the laws as lawmakers. And that was something Susan B. Anthony said in the 19th century. And it's taken a long time to take hold, but now it seems to be not as startling for a woman to run for Congress or to run for the White House. On the other hand, they are being criticized and commentated upon in some of the same very sexist ways that the suffragists were, that they're being too aggressive, that they're being demanding, they're not being feminine, they're not smiling enough, they're not dressing feminine enough. All of these were hurled at the suffragists. And so I think what we can learn and take heart is to watch this movement grow and then come to this really dramatic climax, is the story I tell of what happens in 1920 for the ratification, the last state needed to ratify. But also in the whole seven-decade span, these women were fighting for seven decades, three generations of women, 900 state, local, and national battles, and yet they kept persisting. They're the original, she persisted. They keep picking themselves up after defeats and disappointments and betrayals, and they keep their eyes on the prize, and they say, we're not going to be detained or deferred. And so I think when we see this story of how hard it was, what it took for these women to stand up and be condemned in their own communities, you know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't, in some ways, it was hard, much harder for women then to stand up and say, I'm for political equality, I'm for equal rights for women, because they were condemned by their ministers and their priests and their rabbis. They were thrown out of their clubs. They were chastised in their local press. It was a brave thing to stand up. And I think by learning about this, by seeing the gumption that they portrayed and the political acumen, you know, they are masterful politicians. They have to be. They're not just protesters. They're also campaigners. They're lobbyists. They're drafting legislation. They're working with friendly legislators. They're building coalitions. And to see that happening 100 years ago when they didn't have the right to vote yet, I think is very inspiring. And one of my favorite things of having the book out in hardback for the last year in the 18 elections that we just went through in November,
right.
The midterms, when so many women were running, that pink wave you described. And I got many notes from readers saying, you know, I took your book into the voting booth with me for inspiration. You know, it gave me a sense of why I need to vote. So that was very gratifying to me.
Will it always, and does it always have to be a fight? We could talk about this in the terms. I mean, we just were talking about race on the program. We're talking now about women's rights and voting. Does it have to be a fight in the sense of to make it understandable? Which could as easily be replaced by the question of why does it always have to be a fight?
Well, I think in terms of suffrage, which was, again, just one part of a larger women's rights agenda. The right to the franchise was really just one of a much broader idea. And I'll just say that Alice Paul, one of the leaders of the suffrage movement in 1920, says after ratification is accomplished, says, okay, fine, we've got that first important step, but now we have to try to get all the others, equality in education, in economics, in pay, in all the other aspects of life. And she and several other characters in my book actually draft what we know as the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's introduced into Congress in 1923. So it's been a long, long time that we've been trying to get legislation that would go into the Constitution that would make it the law, that equality in all other aspects. But does it have to be a fight? I think to understand this, you have to realize that the question of whether women should have the right to vote, should have political equality, was not just a political issue. It wasn't just a voting rights issue. It was a cultural and societal and, for some, a moral issue, a debate about women's role in society. So it was much larger. It was much deeper. And that meant it aroused passion. That we don't normally think of when we think of this movement. So you had cultural and religious conservatives who said, oh, no, this is against God's plan. Women should not be equal to men. Adam is dominant over Eve. That's what the Bible says. And so they use biblical language to try to thwart equal rights. And then there's the social conservatives and cultural conservatives. Again, many of these women, anti-suffrage women, and there was an entire movement of them, who say, no, this is going to disrupt the American home. Women are going to abandon their families and their children to go out and vote or to campaign for the vote. This is the same argument that's used many decades later for women going out to work. And certainly now women entering politics. Oh, they're going to abandon the home. That's their first responsibility. And, you know, that's not a question that's asked of men. So you see these women saying this is going to disrupt in an unhealthy way gender roles, and men are going to be emasculated by it, and women are going to wear the pants in the family, and there are going to be more divorces because men and women will argue about politics. And isn't it better if men just make those decisions for women? So a lot of those same fundamental emotional questions are still with us. They may take slightly different forms, but they really are still with us. So when you say, why is it a fight, it's because it goes deeper than even just the right to vote.
But it was a fight then, and it's a fight now. I'm right now, as we are talking, I'm looking up at a monitor that has the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen taking questions on border security from a lot of white men. And so my question is that's still, why are we still fighting that? What you're writing about is 1920. Here we are in 2000 and almost 2020, as we go to our next major election cycle. And I'm curious as to the, when I ask about the fighting question, a lot of change has happened in the last 100 years, and I'm wondering the understanding of why many ingredients in this stew have not been changed.
Well, I think it does come down to what is an accepted societal view of women's role. And until we see that as it's nothing out of the ordinary for women to be leaders and women to be in power, and the idea that women who have power are threatening, then we're going to still be fighting this battle on both the personal and on the policy front. So I think that a lot has improved. But we are still, even with this great pink wave, we're just about a quarter of representation in Congress. And you'd say, well, why isn't it half? And, of course, before this election, it was much, much less than a quarter. And look at the state houses. There's been great gains in representatives, female representatives in the state houses, but it's still not equal. And why is that? And part of it is you still hear people saying, well, I just can't envision a woman being a political leader, a woman in the White House. I can't accept that. And women say that, too.
I was going to say, yeah.
Women said that for suffrage. There were organized anti-suffrage women organizations in many, many states and many cities. And they certainly show up in my story in Nashville, Tennessee, in the summer of 1920. And they are tearing the suffragists apart. They are, castigating them as radicals, perverts, manly, unsexed. They call them Bolsheviks because they want to upend, societal norms. They are not polite in how they fight to keep suffrage away from women. So we still live with that idea that, of course, can't expect all women to think alike. It's not monolithic.
No. Nope.
Certainly the suffrage movement wasn't. They had a common goal, but they wanted to go about it different ways. The movement splits over tactics and strategies. There's the idea of Southern women. Some Southern suffragists did not want black women to vote. Not all, but some did not. And, of course, the anti-suffragists really use race as a hammer to bludgeon the suffragists because they fear that the 19th Amendment would and did make it legal for all women to vote in every state. And they didn't want black women to vote because that would upend the Southern society that they were trying to preserve and the racial hierarchies that they had tried to preserve. So they attack the 19th Amendment as both on the grounds of states' rights and also the idea that it would allow black women to vote.
Elaine Weiss is our guest. The name of the book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It says in this paperback release, soon to be a major television event. How did that come about and how will that take shape?
Well, as you might imagine, one of the great pleasures any author has is to hear from readers. And I did hear from one of my readers, who happened to be Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton, who thought the story was very important that I tell in the book, and the story was very riveting and moving to her. And so we met and agreed to partner on bringing it to as wide an audience as possible. And so we are partnering with Steven Spielberg's Amblin production company to bring the story I tell in the Women's Hour to the screen. So that's what we're working on right now. It's very exciting.
When you think of Hillary Clinton deciding not to run, that is the news of this week, and you think of, and she said obviously she wants to be a very active participant in the coming dialogue, what do you make of the current situation of the women who are running and what they can gain from Secretary Clinton's experience?
Well, I guess I have read that she is, they have, many of the candidates have gone to Secretary Clinton for advice on what the road looks like. She's certainly been through it. And I think she believes fervently in the democracy that we have to uphold as citizens. That's why this story spoke to her so deeply. It's about both the sacred privilege and right of voting and how hard it's been to gain it, and the idea that women can lead. This is something that the suffragists saw as, again, the right to vote is the first step, and then the right to be elected by, again, women could run before the 19th Amendment. Many states did not prohibit women from running for office, but it was ridiculous to think that they could win. They were not going to win because men were not going to vote for them. So until women could vote, there was no sense that women would be elected to office. So this is a story that kind of gives you the underpinning of how women's role in representing us, not just voting, but representing us, comes about. And, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually runs for Congress in 1866.
Right.
And she thanks all 13 men who voted for her because those were the only ones who voted for her. She says her 13 male friends. So, again, until women can vote, it's kind of silly to think that women will be elected. So I think what Secretary Clinton can give is both very practical, a hard-won, painful experience, and also the bigger vision. And I think I've heard her express that, and it's very eloquent.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us. Elaine Wyse's new book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It is a beautiful book and a very important book, and I thank you for sharing with us this morning.
A pleasure, Joe. I'm really great to be with you again.
Thank you very much. Elaine Wyse's new book is The Woman's Hour. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.